You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
Well, what's common to Fifth Avenue in New York City, Regent Street in London, IFC in Hong Kong, Ginza in Tokyo, Champs-Élysées in Paris? Well, for one, they're among the most upmarket and prestigious streets in the most prominent cities of the world. For another, a consistent major attraction on all these streets is the Apple Store. And now it appears Mumbai could have its own brush with Apple Store fame. Despite Tim Cook declaring India a crucial market for Apple in the long term, the Cupertino giant's inroads into India have been far from successful. Less expensive Chinese brands like Vivo and Xiaomi have ruled the roost here. This price cut for the premium iPhone XR notwithstanding, they're still not selling as many iPhones as they do elsewhere. Will a new store in a posh part of Mumbai generate more interest in India? That is what Apple hopes for, and whether or not it will happen, we will know in a few weeks when Apple announces where in Mumbai the Apple Store will be. Something tells me it's going to be in BKC, but I'll wait to be proven wrong. With that bit of juicy Apple news, the side note, Indians may not rush to buy Apple products, but we sure love talking about them. After that piece of juicy Apple news, let's get to the biggest stories of India and the world. My name is Rakesh Sharma, and you're listening to Money Control.
Editor's pick of the day.
Let's check in with the jet saga first. There are some unknown bidders who have shown interest in the embattled airline, which is struggling to survive now. A British citizen called Jason Unsworth, who is the founder of airline startup Atmosphere Intercontinental Airlines and a fairly relatively unknown, if rather mischievous entrepreneur, has joined hands with one more guy called Lakshay Uttam, the founder of My World Ventures, which is an Amsterdam-based travel and hospitality firm, to submit a bid for Jet Airways. Uttam even went so far as to say that the two have been in touch with Naresh Goyal. Goyal's daughter, on her part, has refuted these claims. Future Trend and Adi Partners earlier teamed up with Jet Airways founder Naresh Goyal to submit an expression of interest for the airline. Redcliffe Capital submitted the EOI along with Think Capital, but none of those was shortlisted to put in a bid. The shortlisted bidders are Etihad Airways, TPG Capital, Indigo Partners, and the NIIF. May 10th is the deadline to submit bids for Jet Airways. Jet suspended all its operations, as we know, on the 17th of April, and since then, the future of once the largest airline in the country has been in grave jeopardy. The employees, in an almost cinematic move, have come up with their own proposal to prevent the airline from sinking, but SBI Caps, which is overseeing the bidding process, will take the final decision. In more jet-related news, Money Control has learned that the Enforcement Directorate is probing Etihad's 2014 investment in Jet Privilege, the company that operated Jet Airways' frequent flyer program. According to our source in the Enforcement Directorate, Etihad's 900 crore rupee investment in Jet Privilege may have been a violation of FDI limit norms. The ED has called the senior management of Jet Airways next week to understand the deal structure. Money Control has also learned that the Enforcement Directorate is looking into Naresh Goyal's investments in various foreign airlines. These troubles at Jet are in addition to the recent discrepancies that the IT department has found in the books of the airline. The only question we're asking these days is Jet set to be gone? And the answer to that we will know soon enough. From a veteran company in its unexpected sunset days to a company that is in its infancy on Dalal Street, let's go to Neogen Chemicals, which is quite clearly a neo star in the bursars. It listed its shares at 251 rupees apiece on the Bombay Stock Exchange, a premium of 16.74% against the issue price of 215 rupees. The initial public offer of Neogen Chemicals, which ran between the 24th of April and 26th of April, received a huge response from the investors as the issue was overall subscribed 41.18 times. The price band for the issue was 212 to 215 rupees per share. The stock rallied 22.58% to close at 263 rupees 55 paise on the BSE, which was also its intraday high. Compared to the opening price of 251 rupees, the stock was locked in 5% upper circuit on the NSE as well. It closed at the same price against issue price of 215 rupees. Volume was at 2.88 lakh shares on the BSE and 13.58 lakh shares on the National Stock Exchange. At closing price, Neogen's market capitalization stood at 614.98 crore rupees. Patanjali's first ever major acquisition has run into some troubled waters. According to a report by PTI, Singaporean lender DBS Bank on Wednesday moved the NCLT seeking a higher payout from the 4,350 crore rupee offer by Patanjali to take over the crippled edible oil firm Ruchi Soya. An NCLT bench of judges asked Ruchi Soya and DBS, which holds the first charge for the plant and the machinery of the crippled company, to file their detailed submissions by the 10th of May. Making its case for a relook at the payout for financial creditors, DBS said it enjoys the first charge for the plant and the machinery of Ruchi Soya, which owes 243 crore rupees to it through an external commercial borrowing. This is Ruchi Soya to DBS. Just as a reminder though, the fair value of Ruchi Soya is 4,161 crore rupees and it owes over 9,345 crore rupees to the lenders led by State Bank of India. Now moving on to some national and also international news, Wilbur Ross, the United States Commerce Secretary and also, I suppose, a contemporary of Montgomery Burns from The Simpsons, has come down to India and come down hard on it. Accusing India of imposing restrictive trade policies that burden foreign companies, Ross has echoed much the same things that Donald Trump has said about India, which, by the way, he calls Tariff King. As you know, he has gone on and on about Harley Davidson motorbikes and how the tariffs in India are very high, etc., etc. Among the concerns that Wilbur Ross has voiced is the issue of data localization. As we know, the Indian stand is that financial and other sensitive information about its citizens should be stored in the country, something that the US would like to be changed. Ross said at an event, and I quote, "Currently, US businesses face significant market access barriers in India. These include both tariff and non-tariff barriers, as well as multiple practices and regulations that disadvantage foreign companies," unquote. The US also views India's e-commerce policy as being discriminatory toward firms like Amazon and Walmart-owned Flipkart. According to Ross, bilateral trade between the two countries stood at $142 billion in 2018, up $16 billion over 2017. According to India's numbers, bilateral trade stood at $79.8 billion in April to February FY19, up from $74.5 billion in FY18. The US figures included services as well. Now, Wilbur Ross is a billionaire, from one American billionaire to Indian billionaires. By the way, they are on the rise. And sadly, you and I are not billionaires yet. Whatever your own bank balances might be, the country is busy producing more billionaires than ever. According to a new report by Knight Frank, the number of billionaires in India more than doubled to 119 between 2013 and 2018. And India will lead the global growth in ultra-high net worth individuals, with its numbers rising 39% to 2,697 by 2023. Even as the old guard, led by the likes of Anil Ambani, Vijay Mallya, Shashi and Ravi Ruya of SR, Tulsi Tanti of Suzlon Energy, have lost their billionaire status thanks to several problems in each of their businesses, the country has seen the rise of the young tech entrepreneur, with the likes of Sachin Bansal, Binny Bansal, Vijay Shekhar Sharma of Paytm, and Baiju Ravindran of Baiju's, all reaching billionaire status in this new economy led by the digital revolution. Now, if you thought the GDP controversy had died, well, think again. In a new development to add to the saga of revised GDP data, Mint has revealed in an exclusive report, quoting NSSO, that is the National Sample Survey Office, that key data used to compute GDP numbers under the new method are now turning out to be patently dodgy. The NSSO has found that 36% of the companies taken into account for the new GDP calculation are either untraceable or had been categorized wrongly. Should these companies' numbers be removed from the analysis, the India GDP story is not going to look as healthy as it looks. It's going to read very differently. According to the Economic Times, and I quote, NSSO stumbled upon these serious anomalies while the 74th round of its survey of the services sector was underway, according to the report. 15% of the companies in MCA 21, which lists details such as addresses, etc., were found to be either closed or untraceable. 21% of the companies turned out to be out of coverage, which meant they were not functioning in the service sector despite having registered themselves under that head and continuing to feature in official data as service sector entities. Even many of the correct entries, those registered under and operating in the service sector, either didn't answer NSSO's questions or had not maintained any useful data. dodgy, dodgy, dodgy. The issue of non-presence was the starkest in the case of companies picked from the MCA21 database, the NSSO said. About 45% of MCA units, that is Ministry of Corporate Affairs units, were found to be out of survey or casualty, while the Economic Census of Business Register frame had about 18% such cases. It said the Mint report, quoting R. Nagraj, who is a professor at Indira Gandhi Institute of Development Research. MCA 21, and I brought that up once here. What is MCA 21? It is a database of companies maintained by the Ministry of Corporate Affairs. The ministry had deemed these companies as active companies. The use of MCA 21, which the Central Statistics Office sourced from the Corporate Affairs Ministry, was one of the most important changes made to the computing process when the new GDP series was launched in 2015. So MCA 21 is at the heart of this controversy about GDP revision, because these were the data that was used. Now, after the change in the base year, the preceding year's GDP numbers were also revised, ostensibly, or at least this is what they claimed, to arrive at a fair comparison of how the country fared during the UPA years and the NDA years. The new series adjusted GDP numbers for the fiscal years 2005 to 2012 using new methodology, with FY12 as the base year. Now, what happened after that is a story familiar to all of you, but a quick glimpse of what it was. The main takeaway from all of that was that GDP growth during UPAs came out lower, with a peak of 10.3% in FY11, which was later scaled back to 8.5% under the back series. It also showed that the first 4 years under Modi as clocking a higher average growth compared to the UPA years. Now, following the back series revision, average growth under UPA for FY06 to 12 fell to 6.82% from the earlier 7.75%. In comparison, average growth in the 4 years under Prime Minister Modi was found to be 7.35%, which is significantly higher than the Manmohan era numbers. Now, it appears it's time for this can of worms to be reopened again and see how much truth there is to this revision. Now, Deepak Shanghvi, one of the richest men in the country, the founder and owner of Sun Pharmaceuticals, still has his set on Suzlon. Despite witnessing degrading financial health year after year, Indian billionaire Dilip Shanghvi, did I say Deepak Shanghvi earlier? I meant Dilip Shanghvi, is not yet ready to give up on renewable energy major Suzlon Energy. In an interview with Bloomberg, Shanghvi expressed intentions to stay invested in the unprofitable wind turbine maker, adding that policy hurdles were responsible for lower demand for Suzlon's wind turbines and the resultant cash squeeze. The founder of India's largest drug maker, Sun Pharma, said, and I quote, "If I look at outcome, then clearly that investment hasn't had a great outcome." In 2015, Shanghvi bought a 23% stake in Suzlon for 18 billion rupees, or about 1,800 crore rupees, helping the company to return to profitability after it became India's largest convertible bond defaulter in 2012. The 63-year-old businessman opined that his investment in Suzlon 4 years ago was based on the assessment that within the renewable energy sector, the company had the product and the future pipeline which will allow them to grow. But in the last couple of years, that hasn't happened. India has shifted from fixed tariff program to auctions for wind projects, thereby increasing competition among suppliers. This in turn has significantly impacted the business of Suzlon as its market share and profit margins went tumbling. Competition from service companies, competition from other companies like Vestas Wind Systems and Senvion SA has also added to the problems of Suzlon. In April, in fact, rating agency CARE had cut the long-term bank facilities of the company to default from BB after Suzlon failed to meet a repayment obligation to its lenders. Moreover, it has $172 million in foreign currency convertible bonds due in July. Suzlon's market value peaked at 10,900 crore rupees a few weeks after Shanghvi announced his investment. However, the value has plunged over 7,600 crore rupees since then to 3,300 crore rupees as of the 8th of May. And finally, the New York Times tells us that Donald Trump is a loser of a lot of money. By the time his Master of the Universe memoir called Trump, The Art of the Deal hit bookstores in 1987, Donald J. Trump was already in deep financial distress, losing tens of millions of dollars on troubled business deals, according to previously unrevealed figures from his federal income tax returns. And thus, those were the opening lines of an explosive report by the New York Times about the financial health of Donald Trump in the years between 1985 and 1994. To describe it, I would have to borrow one of his characteristic descriptors, and here it goes. Quote, "Sad!" Exclamation point. Now, The Times went on to say, and I quote, "The data, which is printouts from Mr. Trump's official IRS tax transcripts with the figures from his federal tax form, that is the 1040, for the years between 1985 and 1994, represents the fullest and most detailed look to date at the president's taxes information that he has kept from the public view. The numbers show that in 1985, Mr. Trump reported losses of $46.1 million from his core businesses, which were largely casinos, hotels, and retail space in apartment buildings. These losses continued to happen, and he continued to lose money every year, totaling $1.17 billion in losses for the decade." That is from 1985 to 1994. In a break from what has almost been tradition for presidential nominees for over 40 years, as you well know, Donald Trump did not submit his tax returns during the 2016 elections. 2 years since taking office, he has still not submitted them, initially saying, "Oh, I'm under audit and it's too complicated, you won't understand." And now, over time, when people have kept on asking for it, he's turned rather belligerent and saying, "You don't actually need to know and I don't actually have to show, because this is not a question of the law and the law does not ask me point blank to submit my tax return, so in fact, I won't." The Democrats, who last year won the midterm elections, or at least took the House back, have now submitted several requests for the president to submit his tax returns, something he has refused to do even now, going so far, in fact, as suing his creditors, that is like Deutsche Bank, in a bid to prevent them from releasing his financial information. So he can go to any length in order to prove that he is wealthy. And that has always been a huge problem. That is his Achilles heel. Trump has always been a bit touchy about how much wealth he possesses, largely because it is quite likely, as many people have speculated, that he does not possess very much wealth in the first place, or that whatever he does possess is what he inherited from his father. In 2018 American dollars, as in terms of 2018 money, whatever money he received from his father as inheritance could be as much, or if not more than $400 million. Some people have said whatever money he got from his father, if he just kept in a bank and fixed deposit and whatever else, like investment, etc., and done nothing and made absolutely no other business, he would be way richer than he claims to be right now. So basically, what it tells you is TLDR, too long didn't read or too long didn't listen, he has not been a particularly successful businessman, or, well, a successful businessman at all in the first place. Now, part of the reason why I'm bringing this up is because one of the reasons why he appealed to a large section of crossover America, or flyover country as they call it, was the tales about his extraordinary wealth and extraordinary success and his extraordinary ability to make deals, etc. So this is how he sold himself. Every time he went on one of those rallies, he said, "Oh, I can do this. Oh, I can do that. Nobody else can do what I do," etc., etc. Blue collar America saw in him someone very inspiring and someone inspirational, someone they wanted to grow up to be. He had that tale going for him. I mean, although he came from money, but he made it seem like it was all his own success. And a lot of people responded to that success story. They believed him. They valued him because they saw him as a rich and powerful and successful man. Now, that lie about his wealth was very much the foundation of his personal mythology. There have always been doubts about his wealth. Many newspapers have spoken about it. They've done exposés on it. They've always expressed doubts about the wealth that the Donald possesses ever since he has been in the public eye. But of course, he's a marketing genius. He understands how important the idea of him being thought of as rich and successful is to his brand. So he will maintain it. But he may be a marketing genius, but a deal-making dud and a fairly unsuccessful businessman. Some people have even gone on to say he's an overall failure of a businessman. So whatever his mind has conjured about how much wealth he has, unfortunately, his hands have not been able to grab. Now, what is his financial health now? That is the question, because those reports only spoke of 1985 to 1994. That is one decade. And since then, it has been 25 years. Did its continued deterioration, did the financial health continue to deteriorate? And did that lead him cutting nefarious deals with all kinds of shady people? Do they have anything to do with Russia? Do they have some compromat, as they say? Do they have some compromising information about Donald Trump? And is it based on these things that he's taking whatever decisions he might be taking? Could the fear of being caught in his attempts to appease these adversaries who have some compromising material about him, could they have guided him to obstruct justice? As the Mueller report has already said, there are 10 cases of obstruction of justice. All of these questions really do need answers. And they will need answers only if he releases his full and transparent tax returns. The House Democrats now have a job to do, and perhaps, just perhaps, even a president to impeach. Well, those were the biggest stories today. Do write into us, mcpodcast@nw18.com. Until the next time you hear from me, this is me, Rakesh Sharma, on behalf of the Money Control Podcast Desk, saying thank you for joining us and do stay with us on moneycontrol.com to be a smart listener and an even smarter investor.
This has been today's Editor's Pick, and you've been listening to Money Control.